Hello and welcome to another podcast from the Sussex Cricket Museum. And today I've got a feeling that the 2023 cricket season has probably faded into our memories a little bit. But we're at Hove, we're on the boardroom balcony. The sun is shining, but I think autumn is probably just round the corner. We've got two guests today. The first person is not really a guest. John Barclay, I think I can call you more of a friend of the podcast, John.
Very much a friend of the podcast and a great privilege to be joining in. Thank you so much.
Lovely. Thanks for coming along. And my other guest, I won't reveal his name first of all, but we'll just go through a few facts before we welcome him. So he was registered blind at the age of 20. He's played blind cricket for England and Sussex. He started off working at the Change Foundation and he was there for 13 years, developing and delivering sport for development programmes in the UK and internationally. He's now CEO of the London Youth Games. He played blind World Cup cricket in India and lost in the semi-final, I think. I was listening to a previous podcast that he did for another channel, and a couple of the words that he mentioned in that podcast were resilience and positivity. And I'm sure they'll come back out today in our chat. But the person we're interviewing today is Andy Dalby-Welsh.
Great to be here. Thank you so much for inviting me.
Lovely. Well, let's have a chat.
Well, Keith, thank you so much. And what a joy to be sitting here on the balcony at Hove, just outside the boardroom, looking at a completely empty ground, as it were, devoid of spectators, end of season, October. Remarkably warm, isn't it, Keith? I mean, it's a warm day, Andy. It's quite warm. Yeah.
It's absolutely stunning.
Shirt sleeves order. And I am going to describe, now Andy's sight obviously is not very good, and we'll come to that within his career and his life. But I'm just going to tell everybody who's listening that sitting here, I'm looking out upon a wonderful green carpet, a carpet of green, an outfield that is so perfect, it could almost, I think, be used as a bowls green. And the cricket square itself, which has a sort of yellow hose around it for some reason, just protecting it from nothing very much, possibly pigeons, is also reseeded and is in incredibly good condition, bearing in mind we're in early October and the season only actually ended right at the end of September. So Hove is the most idyllic place to be. It's a wonderful atmosphere. And Keith, as you said, it's a real joy to welcome Andy. And I'm going to kick off, Andy. I mean, perhaps I shouldn't, but we first met up, would you believe? This is going to make us feel quite old.
Sure is.
We first met up some 20 years ago when Andy was playing for England in the blind and partially sighted World Cup competition tournament.
Right.
And we visited Chennai in India, where the tournament took place. So that was where we started. And I'm sure that the listeners would actually, Andy, love to hear how you came to be in Chennai with the blind and partially sighted as part of the team aged about 20-ish.
Yep, absolutely.
How did that all come about?
Well, Sussex were absolutely at the heart of it, John. As mentioned earlier, I developed a rare eye condition when I was 20.
Yeah.
I'd been a keen cricketer growing up. Nothing particularly special, but being at the county ground is always great. I remember coming down when I was a young lad and doing nets in the chalet. But when I was 20 and my eyes deteriorated, I thought my sporting days really had, probably that was that. But it was Sussex who set up a blind cricket team and I heard about this. And I actually remember meeting you through my first blind cricket experience when you kindly hosted us at Arundel. in one of the most idyllic cricketing settings and provided us with the most exquisite lunch that guaranteed for me that this game of blind cricket was for me, if this is how I was going to get looked after.
I love the idea that you're suggesting that I provided you with this idyllic lunch, but it was obviously the catering team at Arundel. I mean, I'm so happy you remembered Arundel not only for its beauty and for being on that lovely field and practising and playing, but you remember it from the lunch.
Absolutely. Food still is the way to my heart, and that certainly got me off to a good start. So it was an incredible sort of introduction to blind cricket. I had no idea what blind cricket was. I remember being incredibly nervous, not knowing anyone. I mean, I was early 20s, but it was still new. And I remember I'd finished playing quite some time ago, and one of my mates who was still playing, I asked to borrow his kit because I didn't even know what ball would be used, thinking this is going to be still a cricket ball of some description. So I rocked up with a bag full of pads, helmet, the gloves, the box, the full works, and found out that actually we played with quite a different ball in blind cricket and didn't need much of my kit bag after all.
I think that's so interesting. Just before we move on to that World Cup tournament, I think that our listeners would be very interested and also encouraged in many ways to hear that obviously from the age of, I mean, I don't know, 10, and as you were a teenager, at that stage your eyesight was fine. But at some stage it began to deteriorate. I think our listeners would be interested to know how you have coped with that, and you have coped with it outstandingly well, but how you coped with what was a huge setback, I suppose, towards the end of your teens. But, you know, age 10, good eyesight?
Perfect.
There we are. So how did that sort of evolve, Andy?
Well, it was a big shock and a surprise, John, to be honest. I went to university at the age of 20, was doing all the things anyone would normally do in their first year at university, having a great time trialling and playing for the
Where
university football team. I was in Birmingham.
Oh, great, yeah.
And it was pretty much in mid-late March time of my first year that I realised, and it was while I was playing football actually, that I just wasn't able to see the ball like I could before, and I couldn't quite work out why. And I went to lectures and I couldn't see the board at the front of the class, and I couldn't work out why. And then I went to the doctors, sent me to the opticians sent me to hospital. And really at that point it became clear that it was only one eye at that point, but that my right eye had deteriorated significantly. It was pretty much the end of term, and I had a skiing holiday booked, so I didn't want to, never an opportunity missed, so I didn't want to cancel that. I went and skied, but with only sort of beginning to have partial sight. And then when I came back from that skiing trip, my other eye started deteriorating. And from really that end of March period of noticing it, I became registered blind on the 11th of May, just about 10 weeks later. So very quick and quite a shock.
And Andy, how did you cope with that, both from a mental point of view and a physical point of view?
It was tough, but it was also just, it was quite surreal.
Yes.
It was a genetic condition, but no one had developed it in my family before. So although it being genetic, we didn't know it existed. And actually, I sort of went through it with my mum, really, and it was passed on by my mum, so she almost, I think, found it more difficult than I did to deal with the sort of guilt of that, whereas I obviously didn't want her to hold any sort of guilt related to that whatsoever. But people have asked me this before in terms of how I cope with it, and I think what I feel incredibly fortunate for is to have had an incredibly positive and supportive group of friends. Yes. And an amazing family who all rallied round. And on top of that, a local charity to here called the Blatchington Court Trust.
Yes.
I met very early on, met a couple of ladies who were blind, who came and demonstrated that actually what they got up to in life and what they were achieving showed that even with no sight at all, you can achieve so much. And it just gave me a positive platform to be able to think, actually, I can still achieve.
So family, friends, your circle, your sort of social circle, a massive help during that very frightening, I imagine, frightening phase when you just don't quite know what's happening or where it's going.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we didn't know where it was going at first, and through many sort of tests sort of day in, day out for them to try and understand, and it was only when they were then able to diagnose what it was that it became clear that it wasn't going to get better. But once it had reached a certain point, it probably wasn't going to get any worse either. So I think, again, one of the positive things of that was that I knew what I was dealing with.
Yes.
And although it not being easy to deal with, I knew what it was, and could start thinking about what life held for me going forward from that point.
Yeah. So, Andy, we came to us meeting up through the concept of blind cricket, blind cricketers, partially sighted, and making great friends, first of all at Arundel. It was nice to remember that. And then the World Cup tournament, and I was very privileged and very lucky to be invited to go along as manager of that team. I'm not sure I did very much, Andy, to be absolutely honest. I did enjoy it hugely. And we had a wonderful coach on that tour called Andy Sellins, who people may know very well from this broadcast. But Andy was quite inspirational, I thought.
He absolutely was, and has remained to be honest. I saw Andy, I think, 2 weeks ago Friday, to catch up, and I also remember the first sort of England blind training session I was invited to. Again, first sort of experience of the game and not knowing what to expect. And I remember Andy standing up alongside the captain at the time, Adam Benjamin, and I just felt inspired and enthused to want to be part of what was in front of me. It was so exciting, and I think what I thought I wasn't going to be able to do any longer in terms of sport as competitively as I played it before was sort of laid out in front of me, and it was looking as competitive, if not more competitive, than anything I'd done before. And Andy's sort of ability to sort of present that as an opportunity was just amazing.
Well, it was amazing. Now, I know that our listeners would, many people have said to me, you know, how on earth do people without or with very poor sight play cricket at all? How does it happen? How does it work? So I wonder if you could sort of give an idea, give an explanation of how the international blind cricket match actually functions, and what happens, and who does what, and roughly how it works. And then we might move on to Chennai.
Absolutely. I mean, it's incredible how it works. And the reason I love it so much is not only the opportunity that it has provided me, but it is so fantastically inclusive. And so what I mean by that is that there are 11 players in a blind cricket team, four of which are totally blind. Three are of a category, which is B2, but that is at the lower end of partial sight. And then you have four B3s, as they're categorised, and they have a bit more sight than your B2s. Now, the game is played with a ball that is the same size as a cricket ball, but it's a hard white plastic ball with noisemakers in it. And the ball is bowled underarm, with the bowler having to ask the batsman before bowling if they're ready. They will say yes when they're ready, and then the bowler has to release the ball. Obviously, they release the ball and they have to say play as they release the ball, with the ball bouncing in both halves of the pitch. And so the sound, obviously, enables the batsman to be able to hear it coming. The fact it's got to bounce in both halves of the pitch means that it is, if it's bouncing, it's a very low bounce, or it's rolling along the floor. And the batsmen are able to score, the B1, the totally blind batsmen, are able to score double runs, which again makes them a huge asset to the team if you've got some strong batsmen.
I mean, that is it's so riveting. What it is, Keith, and for those, it's in a way, it's a very polite game, but it's very competitive. So the concept of the bowler saying, "Are you ready?" And then play, and that has to happen. I think the umpire calls a stop or no ball.
Absolutely.
So it's a polite but very competitive game, and the ball, if I remember, Andy, is delivered underhand, hard ball, similar size to a cricket ball, quite fast, quite vigorous, isn't it?
It is. It's almost more unforgiving than a cricket ball, because it's just a hard white plastic ball. There's no give in it sort of whatsoever. So it's, it is one where you do need gloves. You do want to bat in a helmet. You do want to wear shin guards if it's coming at you low. I mean, it is. I have two relatively small scars under my eyes, but they're both from catching practice with this particularly hard ball, and evidence if required. Catching was not my forte.
But you can get a top edge too.
You can.
And what about the fielders protecting the field?
Again, the B1s, your totally blind players, huge admiration, because they will often be fielding in those sort of silly type of positions around the bat, and will fall to the ground to create a barrier to stop those sweep shots or those cuts on the offside. And so we'll wear padding to do that. Some will move out a little bit further and react to the noise of the ball, but because obviously they're completely relying on their hearing, being close and being able to react quickly was certainly how we used those totally blind fielders when we were playing, and some incredibly skilled players that could react so fast, and they'd prevent some serious runs being scored.
It was, and the pace of the game, my memory, was it quite considerable. So we practiced, you practiced, I watched, and Andy Sellins coached, and others, we all helped. Everyone joined in with assistance. And off we went to challenge for the World Cup in 2002, I think it was, in Chennai, in India, with England, one of the teams, and there were seven other teams, international teams, so most of the, almost all, of the other, the world's cricketing test-playing countries, absolutely, took part. And off we went to Chennai. Now, can you remember the feel of that atmosphere within the teams and within the tournament that you experienced as basically quite a youngster in India?
I can, and it was bonkers. It was the first time I'd ever left or been outside of Europe was to go on that trip to India. And so even just coming off of the plane and walking into the airport, the assault on your senses was just unbelievable.
What sort of assault? we'd like to have a bit more detail.
The noises were incredible. We weren't as welcomed as I would have thought we might be through an airport. And I think border control were as tough with the England blind cricket team as they might be with anybody else. But we did finally get through, having shared visas and what have you. And again, just walking out of that airport to get on a coach to the hotel, the bibbing of the horns, the traffic that you can hear, the heat that it was. And I think we arrived sort of about midnight. And so you sort of imagined you might be, all my naive thoughts, where you'd walk out, come out at night and all things might be quiet. But it was like midday in London and some. So absolutely bonkers in terms of that first impression, sight, sound, sort of feeling of the whole thing. Just remarkable.
And then we set about practicing, and we had the other seven sides, and I'm trying to think, they were almost all the other test playing sides put in teams to take part. And we all stayed in that same hotel. I think that all... Was that right, Andy?
Yeah, the Hotel Cervera. We all had our own floor, the Cervera.
Well remembered. Good memory.
So, and again, in terms of turning up and that sort of assault on your senses, I remember we got off of the coach. As I say, I think we'd landed at sort of what felt like midnight, so it was midnight, and we arrived in the hotel early hours of the morning, and again thinking, well, you know, we'll check in and everybody will go to bed, it's going to be quiet. We walked through the doors, and not being able to see what was sort of coming, we were presented with a bindi was placed on our foreheads, a flower garland was presented around our necks, there was a band playing in reception, and we're handed some fruit cocktails to sort of enjoy as we're welcomed into the place. And again, it was just like, wow, what? This is absolutely bonkers. And so it was a bit like, well, what's not to love about this? And just a completely different experience within the first few hours of landing in India.
But there was great warmth and generosity from the Indian hosts. I certainly remember that. And I also found it very... Although there was obviously competitive within all the teams being together, there was a sort of sharing to some extent of experience, and there was a very warm and, I felt, generous atmosphere within the hotel. We all stayed in the same hotel. We all went elsewhere to practice. Then, of course, we started our matches. But did you feel that was a sort of certain generosity of spirit within the setup, or was it just me?
I'm with you in your optimism, John, and your experiences of it. I think I certainly felt it around the hotel. I certainly felt it with most of the teams. I think I didn't feel it with the South African handshake before the start of one of our matches. May have been our first match as well. A pretty strong, firm grip, wishing me luck in my sort of first World Cup game. Not sure it was possibly meant, but back to the point on the sort of competitiveness of it. It was a World Cup. You want it to be as competitive as anything, any other World Cup, and it was.
A good memory. So that was our first qualifying match. Do we play? Can you remember the structure of the tournament? How it worked? Because we did very well, I thought. Can you remember how it actually worked?
Yeah, so it was, you're right with the eight teams. I think we were in two groups.
Yes.
And you then played around robin in those groups. Yeah. And top two teams in each group went through to the semi-finals.
Yes, which was us.
It was us. And we got there.
And the length of matches, how long?
40 overs a side.
40 overs a side. So, yeah, quite a long match in heat. Yeah.
Yeah. Definitely. So now, I mean, it was, and again, one experience, but just sweltering, absolutely sweltering. And again, back to Hove, I was really fortunate being here. I was at my final year of university while this was sort of happening, and wonderful being at university. I was studying hard, but it still presented me with a good amount of spare time to be able to go to the gym, get in good order, come here to the Gilligan as it was, and kindly Sussex gave me time in the nets free to practice, and my dad would bowl with me, Andy would bowl at me, I'd bowl at them, because from the moment that I'd been selected, which having only really known about the game for 3 months, to go to a World Cup, I was just absolutely committed that if I was going to go, I'd give myself the best chance of playing.
And Andy, as it turned out, we played, England, I watched, we played outstandingly, really, given everything. And amongst our team, of which Andy was a very important all-round, and also the youngest, I think, probably by quite a bit, or young-ish.
Well, we had, youngish. I mean, we spanned some incredible ages, actually. I mean, that was what was quite incredible about Brian Cricket as well. So I think Si Ledwith, who's a dear friend, yes. And is still playing and playing for Sussex still, I think on that trip was 15 years old, so our youngest player.
Really? I've forgotten that.
Had Jeff Smith, who was instrumental in setting up the Sussex Blind Cricket team and was involved in all of the sort of administrative side of everything with World Blind Cricket Council, I think was in his early 50s as our most senior player on the tour. So incredible span of ages taking part in it.
So this great blend of youth and experience was one of the secrets of our success, I think.
I
you will remember these two players very well. Two players I remember very vividly. Both B1s, no sight. One called Tim Gutteridge and the other called Nathan Foy. And Nathan Foy left-handed, mm-hmm. Tim right-handed, and quite senior,
yep.
Would you say?
Yep, Tim certainly. Nathan, I think, was younger than me.
And they were outstanding. Mm. And as you said, their runs, B1s, counted double. Mm. They were also allowed a runner to assist with running, obviously. And they were amazingly gifted at being able to sense this moving ball with sound in it. And we're really, I think the B1s were one of the notable reasons that we ultimately reached the semi-final. One of the reasons.
They definitely were. Apart from my bowling, I think they were probably one of the significant reasons.
Tell them about your bowling. But
I think, Tim and Nathan, I mean, we made it through to the semi-final. Yeah. And I think we knocked out India in the group stage by beating them and securing a place in the semi-final, which in a sense was a big, big shock. Yes. And it was because in one of those games that Nathan and Tim both batted for a significant amount of those 40 overs, scoring double runs, scoring boundaries. In a couple of boundaries and over and you're at 16 runs and over, it's pretty, if you haven't got someone who can compete with that, you're hard to keep up. And you know, that certainly was a performance that ensured we made it through to the semi-finals.
And tell us, remind me of the semi-final. We did lose the semi-final, and I remember it a pretty tight game, wasn't it? Against Pakistan, was it Pakistan?
It was Pakistan. It was a tight game, and again, Tim and Nathan were a sort of fundamental sort of part of that. I think we were chasing a Pakistan total of probably up in the high 300s. And I think we got off to a decent start, but I think we did lose either Tim or Nathan early-ish. And the way it works is that you have to have a B1 batsman in your first three, second three, and third three. And so we just didn't end up having them at the crease for long enough to be able to compete, and then relying on our partials, who were brilliant, but not being able to score those double runs, we weren't able to keep up with Pakistan. And I think what in terms of the world order of blind cricket, India and Pakistan it's almost a professional sport, or it is a professional sport for them out there. So they are playing it week in, week out. And so for us to have even reached those semi-finals and be competing was a huge success.
Yes.
But having got there was disappointing for sure.
And I must tell you, Keith, we played that semi-final against Pakistan in the main big test match stadium, in Chennai. I nearly said Madras, but it's what it was. That's where it was, but in Chennai, and this huge stadium, and it was a great honour. And actually, to be there and be part of it was outstanding. And you, Andy, and everyone else you know, made it such fun. I'd also be interested, before we move on, I mean, you said this was the first time you had been out of Europe, and there's nothing more different than India, as well as the actual cricket. Were there other aspects of the expedition? We were there, what, about 2.5 weeks?
Yeah,
I can't remember.
2.5 weeks, 3 weeks, I think.
Other parts of it that you remember with fondness and interest that have influenced your life, perhaps?
I think it would be fair to say hanging out with you, Johnny, was one of those things that we had.
That.
Oh, no, it's true. It is true. We had an absolute great time, and we ate in one or two of the finest restaurants that I'd certainly eaten in by that point. And I think we revelled in enjoying some of the same things when it came to that. And your positivity and enthusiasm for life, I just it loved, and the team loved, and we benefited massively from that. So don't underplay your part in what was just a memorable, life-changing trip for so many of us. It was truly special. And we did get out, and I think that was amazing too. And I mean, I didn't think I'd ever travel in my life to play in an international cricket match via tuk-tuk. And so that was a pretty extraordinary thing we needed to do when our coach didn't turn up to pick us up. And it was, you know, the people we were with was both team, you, coaching, you know, we've talked about Andy. Just people who find the positive in the solution. The coach didn't turn up. Everyone could have got a bit twitchy, but no, let's get some tuk-tuks and get to training. And we did, and got to the match via tuk-tuks, and it was absolutely brilliant. And I think we almost got to the point of probably racing each other to the to the match. So,
well, it's a magical place, India. Mm. I don't know whether you came, Andy, on the trip. Several of the players came down with me and with a little squad of them, maybe about 7 or 8, and we went down towards Pondicherry. And we had that one, I don't know whether you came, you must remind me, wonderful lunch, fish lunch, right by the seaside, sort of north of Pondicherry, but quite a little distance. Did you come on that trip?
Yeah, absolutely.
And was, because that was memorable for me, I don't know whether
absolutely. And again, it just those experiences out of the heart of where we were and getting out and seeing part of it. I mean, absolutely, the cricket was hugely important, but I think for the squad and the guys playing to be in India and to see it and to feel it and to be part of it and to get out from that hotel, I think again, brilliant of sort of Andy's approach, your approach is that, you know, life's for living. Get out there and see it. You don't know if you'll ever come back again. And we certainly did that. And so going down to, like you say, where we were and eating an incredible sort of fish lunch in an amazingly beautiful setting. Just amazing.
Well, it's interesting for everyone. Pondicherry is however many miles, not that far, but probably 50, 60 miles south of Chennai, perhaps more. A French town, surprisingly, you might think. And we were north of Pondicherry, and I don't know how we found this fish, or we'd located this fish, and it was the best, or one of the best lunches. Not a huge lunch, but it was almost as if they'd caught the fish, and then they were on our, caught the fish out of the sea, and then we had lunch. And I will never, ever forget the joy of that lunch near Pondicherry, because it was so unexpected, and it was so different from the heat and the smell, if you like, of Chennai, which, you know, is quite an overpowering city, very big city. And I'm so glad that made a difference to you, because, you know, one of the purposes of touring, obviously, is to try and win your tournament and play the best you can. But the other side of it is, I think, how much you can gain from the experience. And you obviously did. And I think almost all the others, probably all the others, did as well. But now, Andy, after that, I wouldn't say I've lost touch, but what came, what, not lost touch, I mean, you've moved on in your career and created a very successful career via sport, through sport. What sort of happened next, and what was the next step onwards from this sensational international appearance?
it I mean, what happened off the back of that, and as you mentioned, Andy, who was our coach then, we got on very well, and Andy ran a charity at the time which was called London Community Cricket Association, and finishing up that tour revealed that the England Blind Cricket Team, following their trip to India in March, were going to be going to Barbados to introduce blind cricket in Barbados. And Andy asked whether I would be interested in joining the team to go and set up blind cricket in Barbados, which I didn't need to think about for very long. It seemed like a pretty good idea. And so I very quickly accepted the offer, and we went out to Barbados, about 12 of us, to introduce blind cricket out there. We played a celebrity game against Desmond Haynes, Gordon Greenidge, Joel Garner to lift the profile of blind cricket. We coached young people, we visited a blind school, and I absolutely loved it. And it was that, partnered with the trip to India and what that did for me, that made me really reflect that if I'd been at school with the visual impairment I have now, school would have been tough, because I only really enjoyed school the days I had PE or I was playing football or I had the opportunity to do sport. The academic side was not my idea of a good time. And it just made me think, well, hang on, if I'd had that visual impairment, life would have been so different when I was younger, and it made me want to try and create opportunities for other young blind and visually impaired people who did have that challenge earlier in their lives and try and find a way to make sport accessible for them.
Yeah. And tell us a bit more about Barbados. How did that project, how did it go, the introduction of blind cricket to West Indians in, albeit, a lovely place?
It went incredibly well.
Yes.
I became very familiar with Banks beer. That's very nice. Became very familiar with warm Caribbean sea. That is also highly recommended. And hot sauce, which is also highly recommended and has remained a friend for many years. But no, in terms of where it went from there, it was incredible, because what we found with the opportunities and expectations for blind and visually impaired people in Barbados when we went, and this was 2003, but the expectations were still that those people could become basket weavers, could become belt makers.
Yeah.
That was almost the expectation for them. And what we were able to do was to get on TV, to get in the newspapers, and actually say, no. They can achieve much more than this and deserve much more than this. And actually, people can feel pride in them because you've got a Barbados blind cricket team.
Yeah.
And so it was amazing, as we were fortunate enough to do with overseas type trips, was to have a reception at the High Commission in Barbados, which also it drew all of those young people that we were, and older blind people that we were coaching while we're out there, to come and have this amazing experience at the High Commissioner's place in Barbados, something that they, you know, never would have had the chance to sort of do. And they were on the news and they were in the newspapers, and their parents were feeling proud of them. And, you know, it was just an amazing thing to do. And for me, I was then very fortunate to work with Andy to start working with the London Community Cricket Association. But setting up blind and visually impaired projects around Sussex and the southeast and London. But we also needed to go back to Barbados several times to help them keep improving. And, you know, that is a magical place to go. And they were magical people to work with. And subsequently, we were able to do that on other islands with a brilliant outcome that the West Indies now will go and take part in blind cricket World Cups when they weren't, John, when we were there in 2002. Mm. So hugely powerful piece of work that had a really brilliant outcome for those islands and those young people.
And all the while, Andy, the London Community Cricket Association, with Andy Sellins, yourself and others, that was gradually developing, and your career there was sort of developing along as well as the Barbados project.
Absolutely. I mean, I, as I say, sort of started coaching other blind and visually impaired young people, and I loved that. I travelled to Guildford on the train from down here in Sussex. Yeah. I travelled to Seven Oaks in Kent to a blind school. I'd go out into Essex to coach at a blind school. And quite often, the young people wouldn't know I was visually impaired until they'd throw the ball back. I'd completely miss it. It'd dunk me on the nose. I'd look a bit stupid. And they'd go, oh, can't you catch it? It's like, well, no, I'm blind. And they're like, where did you get here? And again, in terms of sort of challenging people's yes. perception of themselves, yes. I hope I assisted some of those young people to do yeah. that and think, actually, you can get on a train on your own. You can travel up London on your own. You can do those yes. things. And you know, that sort of response, I'm sure, helped my confidence in my own abilities, apart from not catching a ball when it's thrown at you. But, it did it. But it also reinforced the need for developing those opportunities. And what we were able to do at the London Community Cricket Association, which became Cricket for Change, was to develop more and more opportunities for disabled young people in London to access cricket. So we grew the programme not just to work with visually impaired young yep. people, two brilliant coaches in Mikey Thompson and Tony Joseph, who you know very well, John, would bring young people down to Arundel, would coach them in their school settings, teach them cricket. And we gradually grew a structure yeah. called Hit the Top, which was about helping young disabled people, whether a physical disability, an intellectual impairment or a visual impairment, to be able to access cricket in their school, join a club, take part in a competition, and really benefit from the game of cricket. And it was wonderful to be part of it. And I always remember sort of Tony, when I sort of joined, and him and Mikey were sort of trailblazing with Andy in terms of going into special schools and coaching, and they'd ring up schools and say, hi, we're Tony or Mikey from the LCCA, we want to come and do some cricket coaching. And more often than not, they'd get, well, no, I think you've got the wrong school. We're a special school. And they were like, no, that's why we're ringing your school. Your kids deserve this as well. Yes. And so I think, you know, the London yes. Cricket Community Association, going to Cricket for Change, and now the Change Foundation, pioneered so much yes. in terms of cricket and what you can actually do with it, that is now being used, and the ECB are taking forward and will do to try and solve some of the challenges that still exist yeah. in the game. But it was wonderful to be able to set that up and growingly do it with the counties across London.
Yeah. Do you know, Andy, you said something so important there, which reminded me, when I set about doing some work with blind and partially sighted people, firstly at Arundel, then the World Cup, what I found is when I was in Chennai particularly, is that I came to not realise or feel that I was with people with any disadvantage at all, even though they did have a disadvantage because they couldn't see very well or indeed see at all. But I didn't feel that there was any great disadvantage. And what you've just said, which I think is very powerful, is that you went into schools, you went to special schools, you visited people all over this country, and as it were demonstrated how, despite a disadvantage or disability, whatever it be called, you can do more or less everything. Not quite everything, but more or less. But do you know what? That's what I felt. Mm. And is that how you feel, really, in a way? But when you're with other partially sighted, blind people, it just seems almost normal. At least that's what it felt to me. Very different.
Yeah, and I think that different for different people. And I think what was brilliant about those sort of cricket environments was that everybody in them was encouraged to be their best and do their best, yeah. and supported in an environment that you could do anything. And any experiences yeah. on the trip, you were welcome. We'd make it work. Brilliant, inclusive, positive environments. And I think that's sort of huge. I think, yes, you can strive to achieve whatever you want to, and people will, but I still feel that the barriers exist are sort of social barriers, lack of understanding barriers, and it to achieve as a non-disabled person might, there are still barriers in society that make things just more difficult. And so I think you have to work harder to achieve and still convince people more in the, you know, the work sort of environment that you might have a disability, you might be blind, but actually you can still achieve what anyone else can. You just need the support put in place to enable you to do it.
Yeah. I mean, can you define a little bit more clearly what those sort of barriers tend to be in your daily or weekly life?
I can. I mean, I think I'm fortunate in that I'm in a position of work. I think actually getting those positions of work can be difficult to begin with. So I think there are psychological barriers that employers may hold, shouldn't do, but might hold in terms of being brave and bold and deciding to choose a disabled candidate against a non-disabled candidate. So I think before you've even got into a role, you've got some barriers to potentially overcome. And then I think within roles, there is a brilliant program called Access to Work, which can provide support. But certainly for me, stuff that you have to do at work can just take longer. You know, if you have an IT issue and you can't see what the issue is, it takes longer to solve. And IT is absolutely fantastic in terms of how it's been adapted and how I adapt it or have adapted to use it. But if you can't see it and your software breaks down that would normally talk to you and no one else is around, you are stuck. Documents that, you know, other people might be able to scan read, but actually you are reliant on software that will read it out to you, it takes you longer to read those sort of documents than others. So they're not fascinating barriers, but they just are things that can just take longer.
No, well, thank you for describing that. Just going back, so London Community Cricket Association, which I remember very well, then became
Cricket for Change,
and then the Change Foundation. It just slightly changed. And that has then, so you moved through all of those things, making a huge contribution with lovely people, Tony Joseph, who was mentioned, Mikey Thompson, who's one of my close friends, and lovely people to work with and work for. And now it's, tell me what you're doing now.
So now I'm the chief executive at the London Youth Games, and that is an organisation we've been around for, or the organisation's been around since 1977. And we run a series of events for young people in London that starts in November with a cross-country competition all the way through to June and July. It used to finish at Crystal Palace at the National Sports Centre, and young people represent their borough. We deliver about 30 sports across the year, really about improving physical health, mental well-being, building social integration across London, helping young people feel proud for representing their borough and feeling good about who they are and where they live and representing. And yeah, we now finished for the first time in the last season with a finals festival across the Olympic Park, where we used the Copper Box, the Aquatic Centre, the Velo Park, the Tennis and Hockey Centre, and gave young Londoners, both disabled and non-disabled young people, so again, really trying to build the inclusivity of this, the opportunity to benefit from those legacy venues from 2012.
And Andy, describe a little bit more fully, what's your actual role? I always love asking people what they actually really do, because no one ever asked me ever. So I love to know. So your sort of weekly activity. I know Friday you're working from home, hence you're here today. But what's your actual role as CEO of the World Youth Games, London Youth Games. Nearly got it right.
I know, I've been promoted, which is...
Tell us, we'd love to hear.
It's a very good question, John. So my responsibilities are really around leading the team. As you say, I tend to be at home Mondays, Fridays, but up in London, cross Tuesdays, Wednesdays, Thursdays. Looking at fundraising for the organisation, ensuring that we've got enough money to run the activities that we do, ensuring that our governance are in good order, ensuring we've got a good board of trustees to help oversee our strategic direction and what we're trying to achieve. Working to build a team, and we've got a fantastic team. They're absolutely brilliant in terms of what they deliver and how much they deliver. There's only sort of 10 of us, and the amount that's delivered is just extraordinary. So looking after that team is really key. The money's key, and ensuring that the charity's well run is also incredibly important in this day and age.
So the number one priority, as always, is the people with whom you work. So working that together, getting the most out of them and giving yourself the best chance to achieve those ends. I think that's wonderful. And I think it's wonderful the progress, Andy, that you've made. But I want to finish with the most important thing of all, by a very long way. Your family, because you mentioned earlier, you have to pick up your two girls from school at... probably any time now. I can't. You have to pick up your two girls, and you'll be in terrible trouble if you don't. So you've got the two girls at school in Hove, Port Slade.
Yep, Port Slade.
And your wife at home, or is she working?
She's disappeared for the weekend. I'm hoping she's going to come back, but she's got off to see a friend in York.
Your family. So within all this, family always takes the top priority. The girls are, how old are the girls now?
They're 10 and 9.
Oh, they're quite old.
They are.
Goodness, that's becoming a bit of a handful.
That's it. I've got an extra hour today because they're at Multi Sports Club, which, in terms of my beliefs and what I care about, I'm absolutely thrilled about. So that's great. And this summer was a new chapter for us in that they're playing cricket at Port Slade Cricket Club, which I absolutely love seeing them do. And I'd thrown my hat in the ring to coach the girls' team there, which they only had one girl-specific fixture because the majority of it is mixed, which is brilliant. Yes. But we were sadly rained off at the back end of the season for the girls' tournament. But I think I was the most disappointed person out of any of them. But I think... What I'm love to do with it is to get them playing, and the most important bit is that they enjoy it. But I would also love to try and help develop a girls' cricket team, but also try and do it despite not being able to actually see what they do on the pitch and find out if there's a way I can help them be brilliant whilst not seeing what they're doing.
So your two girls, your remind me, your wife's name is...
Sam.
I knew that. And I really knew that. So Sam is in New York, but she'll be coming back. But it's an interesting... I know people will be interested in this. You have two girls and your wife, Sam, all of whom can see very well and therefore lend a hand. Mm. But you don't... You know, you don't feel at a disadvantage. You don't look as a disadvantage. You never give me that feeling at all, ever. And yet they're there. They're there knowing that Dad has... you know, a disadvantage in life, but they must be so very proud of how you cope with this, what we would see as quite a big setback.
Yeah, I don't know, but at the same time, I think to my girls, I'm just their dad, and I am. They're brilliant. They couldn't be more helpful, and that's without me needing to ask them. It's amazing, and I'm hugely sort of grateful for that. Whether they're as helpful when they're in their teenage years and we're rubbing up against each other, we'll have to wait and see. But for now, they're incredibly helpful, positive, and inclusive, really, of their approach.
And they're obviously sporty or like sport. Is Sam sporty too, a bit, slightly?
A little. She's struggles with the concentration factor of enjoying sport, of watching or possibly participating, but she loves running and she's pretty active. So cycling and running and yoga are up her street.
So school, I'm interested. So the girls are at school at the Portslade...
St Nick's in Portslade. Yeah. Primary school.
And then they're soon going on to secondary.
Yeah, so we've been doing the tours of secondary schools, literally our last one at Packer last night. And so it's
Packer is the Portslade Aldridge Academy.
Right.
Yeah.
That's right. That's potentially on
the agenda.
So we'll sit down and put our choices down shortly.
Well, what a joy. I mean, Keith, have you got anything you'd like to add? We've had such a happy time. I can't believe how happy we've been just sitting in this where the sun is just beginning. The light is now outstanding. I'd just like to tell everybody that the pigeons are having the most wonderful feast of the newly laid seed, which I'm afraid the groundsman is probably disappointed about. We've got pigeons this side and we've got gulls the other side eating up the seed, but it's a most lovely lovely sight.
It is.
Keith, anything to...
Well, I was just... While you were chatting away, the two of you, one question that came to mind, and I think some of our listeners may be interested in this, and I'm sure, John, you can help us as well. When you used to arrive at this ground as a captain, one of the first things you'd do at the beginning of a three-day match would be to study the wicket.
Yes.
And the pitch.
Yes.
Now, you could see it.
Yes.
Andy can't see that pitch. And you would debate, John, for no doubt a long time before you decided on whether you were going to bat or bowl.
Yes, I'd almost always get it wrong.
So, to me, this strikes me as a huge disadvantage that you can't actually get a clear view of the pitch in blind cricket.
You can't, but you can walk it. And so I think that gives you a good indication of what the surface is like. And I think certainly in terms of India and playing international series here, because they're just one day matches, you're deciding to bat or bowl first with only that day being the consideration. And therefore, the consideration, rather than whether the pitch would deteriorate, quite often it would be the dew on the outfield, in that you'd want to bat with a drier outfield than you would at the beginning of the day, because you'd get more bang for your shots. And so it was sort of looking at the conditions more broadly than purely just the pitch to help make that decision.
Okay, that's great. And the other question was, you mentioned about the ball having to bounce on... twice before it reached the batsman. Can you give our listeners an idea? Now, many people will have seen John bowl here and the speed that he's bowling at. Is the speed in blind cricket the same? Is the ball approaching you at the same speed or is it slower?
Much faster than John's, I think.
John, what does a spinner bowl at these days? I mean, a slow bowler.
We didn't have all these speedometers in my day. I used to feel I bowled outstandingly slowly and the batsman had to wait for hours to wait for the ball to get there. The ball in blind cricket, in my experience, Andy would be much better to answer this, is whizzed along the ground or with the bounce each side. Underhand at some pace,
right?
At some speed. I mean, it's not fast by fast bowling overhand standards, but it's at some pace. And Andy's right, very much quicker than my extremely deceptive flight and loop.
But I think as well, what isn't about the sort of the blind cricket with international cricket as well, though, is actually some of the best bowlers. Yep, you could have a fast bowler, but spin bowling, because you can still get the ball to spin across the floor, and changes in pace bowling are sort of as important, because you're relying on hearing for some, and actually if it starts outside leg and moves to outside off and you've picked it outside leg, you've got the ability to deceive people pretty well. And that slow one, if they think it's coming fast but it then slows up towards them and they're through their shot, you're potentially picking up your wickets through bowled. And also, the faster you bowl, for me, I was hopeless at batting. So I was a bowler, hopeless at batting in an international game. The only time I scored any runs was if I had a really fast bowler. I'd get down quickly and play a cut shot on the ground, and it would whiz down towards the boundary because the bowler would put all the pace on it. If they bowled too slowly, I found it incredibly difficult to get away. Yes. So the dynamics of the bowling, although it felt slightly one-dimensional in that it's bowled underarm and has to bounce twice, the swing, the spin, or the changes in pace actually have quite an impact.
Terrific. Thanks very much. Well, look, this has been fantastic. We're going to have to finish here because I think Andy's going to have to go and collect his children. But I think resilience and positivity, the two words that I used at the beginning, certainly apply to Andy and what he's done in his career. And it's quite amazing that all the help that he can give via the Change organisation and the London Youth Games to kids, as indeed Arundel, the Cricket Foundation at Arundel has done, to kids that would not normally get these opportunities. So that's really fantastic. I'd just like to thank you both. To Andy, thank you very much for being interviewed and coming down to see us today.
Pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Lovely. And to Johnny Barclay, I think we described you as preposterously enthusiastic last time. So, thank you very much for coming, Johnny,
today.
It's been
a joy to be here. Thank you very much.
Lovely. That's great. So thanks very much for listening. And don't forget, if you do like these interviews, then please like us on your podcast provider, and they will drop through directly we do a new one. Thanks very much.